Hello, Lloyd.
Hello.
Welcome to Modo. Welcome to the podcast. It's very good to have you on. And thanks for coming all the way down to Birmingham from somewhere up north, I think.
Yes, great to be here. Great to be here. Yeah, I've come down from Yorkshire today.
Very nice.
Yeah.
We're absolutely delighted to have Lloyd on to talk about investing, venture investing in this space, what's happening in clean tech, what's happening in energy, and also some bigger picture stuff around wind and some other things. And Lloyd, we already know each other pretty well, so the disclosure here is Lloyd is on the Modo board. So Lloyd works for Fred Olsen. We can talk about that in a second, who invested in Modo earlier this year. So we already know each other pretty well, but now I get to ask you all the difficult questions. So thanks for coming on. And do you want to maybe give a bit about your background, what you did until here, that kind of thing?
Sure. Yeah. So my background is that I started out at Deloitte. I was there for several years, chartered as an accountant, did a fairly classic route on a grad scheme. I then went into corporate finance and I worked in unloved company divestitures, which is, you know, FTSE 100 businesses selling divisions. Either to trade or
real,
financial buyers.
How they describe it, unloved?
That's how I would describe it.
That's not technical.
Yeah. I don't think that's. I think the industry would describe it that way.
Okay,
but generally that was what it was. And then thereafter, you know, my true passion was to get involved in clean tech and renewable energy. So I joined a fund in Switzerland, and we did lots of different things from anaerobic digestion to onshore wind, a bit of residential solar, and also fiber broadband as well.
Okay. And now, so you joined Fred Olsen a couple of years ago, right?
Yeah, 2020.
And what does Fred Olsen do?
Okay, so...
And what do you do there?
Fred Olsen, Bonheur, there's two names there. I can explain a bit about that. But it's really a conglomerate. I mean, there's lots of different business divisions, and they are doing different things. However, most of the business is aligned in some way to the wind industry. So Bonheur is the listed vehicle, which is listed on the Oslo Stock Exchange. It's been listed for a very long time, since the beginning of the 20th century. And it's part owned in Free Float and part owned by the Olsen family, which is where the Fred Olsen name comes from.
And so anybody can go and buy shares in Bonheur?
Correct.
But there's also a chunk of shares that are exclusively for the Fred Olsen family?
Correct.
Okay.
That's right. And within the business, there's some broad divisions, but I mean... In sort of simplest terms, one of them is the generating business, the renewable energy business. That's mostly onshore wind, but there's a significant pipeline of offshore wind as well. So there's nearly a gigawatt of onshore and then several gigawatts of offshore and onshore wind in the pipeline. And that is spread between Scotland, Norway, Sweden, and then the North Sea, the Irish Sea, etc.
Okay.
And Global Wind Service, which is an installation technicians business in and around Scandinavia. And then the other business which is worth mentioning is Windcarry, which is jackup vessels. So these are the vessels which install offshore wind turbines.
So this is ships on legs, right?
Correct.
Ships on legs.
That's exactly it. So they sail along, they put four legs down, they bring themselves out of the water. That gives the boat the stability to then do these precise movements, crane-based movements, to actually install the pile and then the sail and the blades on top. So it's amazing thing, and that business has actually installed 20% of all of the wind turbines outside China to date.
Wow!
Yeah.
And so, how many vessels, boats do they? I know boats are wrong. What ships, vessels, whatever. How many vessels is fine.
Yeah.
Vessels is fine. how many do they have?
So they've got three vessels, and they've been through an upgrade program. So they are now upgraded with the largest cranes, such that they are able to deliver the biggest turbines out there.
So 10 megawatt plus?
Well, 10 megawatt was the biggest turbine, but now both GE and Siemens are producing turbines at 15 megawatt, and they're looking for bigger turbines. So they're aiming to get to even bigger than that by the end of this decade.
Okay, cool. I guess we're talking about jackup vessels now, but they're pretty crazy. So you can only do jackup vessel stuff in fairly shallow seas, right? So you're looking at sort of continental shelf style installations.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, so there is that, and we also have an innovations business as well, which is Fred Olsen 1848, and they are developing floating wind technology as well, so we're addressing that part of the market. But certainly for the jackup vessels and the offshore wind market as it is now, you are looking at shallower waters, so sub 50 meters, something
like
that.
But there's plenty of it around.
Yeah.
And so what's the history of Fred Olsen? Who is, was Fred Olsen, and what does that mean for the company and also for the push for renewables?
Sure. So the business has been around since 1848. It was set up by the Olsen brothers in Norway. It's now in, I think, the sixth generation. The business has been through lots of different life cycles. So initially it was sailboats moving ice to the UK. And you know, that's transitioned through shipping, through bulk and various other products, fruit, airlines, offshore drilling. So one of the first businesses to drill offshore off the Norwegian shelf. And thereafter pivoted into renewable energy. So, I mean, the business was the first consented the first wind farm in the UK back in the 90s.
Wow.
And then has continued that transition to the point where we've divested everything that was associated with drilling, exploration, oil and gas earlier in the 2010 decade. So it's that transition is now complete. And as I said, those business verticals that you see now are pointing fully towards the energy transition.
And so what do you do at the company?
So amongst my team, you know, I'm here in the UK, the rest of the team is over in Norway. We are fulfilling a corporate venture capital and also a corporate development role. Most of the things that we look at are fitting in with the energy transition. So we're looking for the gaps that are left by being a pure play renewables generator on the renewables side. And also a consultant aligned to the industry. So, you know, one of the things that we spend most of our time talking about, of course, is storage, but also when we think about the industry itself, the supply chain of that. Now, that might not be just the manufacturer of particular components, but when I talk about supply chain, I mean things like consulting services, data, software, et cetera, all these things that need to come together and mesh to make it work. That's what we're looking at. The corporate development side of things is more supporting the other business verticals. So that might be helping them with capital projects. It might be helping them with business cases, you know, whether it be adding two forms of generation together, adding storage to an existing site and things like that.
And you guys have had some pretty big success in wind recently. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, sure. So I think that the biggest project that we have at the moment standalone is the Codling Bank project in the Irish Sea. That's a 1.5 gigawatt project, which is in a joint venture. And that at the moment...
Who's the other party?
It is EDF.
Okay.
And that project is relatively progressed. There is the Irish Oras bidding going on at the moment, I think this year. But that's, you know, that's going to be huge if that goes ahead, which we hope it will. The other one, which was in the headlines earlier this year, was the ScotWind leasing round, which we entered into a JV with Vattenfall. That's an 800 megawatt floating wind project. So, you know, we've touched on floating wind.
Yep.
There's a lot that needs to happen to get a floating wind project up, running, connected, and operational by the end of the decade. But, you know, we're confident that that's going to happen. And certainly, you know, these areas of high wind resource are not conducive to piling the seabed. So this technology solution, which is now being brought online, you know, we are very confident and also, you know, bullish that is going to be realized.
So all systems go to build 800 megawatts of offshore, floating offshore wind. And I think we had Kerry came on recently to talk about floating wind, but I think the biggest we've got in the UK is less than 100 megawatts at the moment, right? So a lot of work to do.
Yes,
there.
Yeah.
How far offshore is it?
It's a long way off Aberdeen. It's a long way off Aberdeenshire. I mean, it's a long way, but I think probably about 100 miles offshore.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so I want to talk a little bit. So we talked a little about corporate development. So I guess that's you and your team supporting the rest of the Fred Olsen business to identify opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
Today we're gonna. I want to pick your brains on the venture world.
Yeah.
You and your team make venture investments, right? Which is investing in startups like Modo, but also in other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So what are you, let's start with what you're looking for.
Mm. So when we think about different cases, we're looking for an identifiable niche. That's a fairly common requirement, but you know, it's looking for something, a technology or a business which properly addresses a problem. There's plenty of businesses that create a straw man problem and then their technology miraculously addresses that. But, you know, real problems that people are faced with, whether that's, you know, overcoming a technological hurdle, whether it's making an efficiency gain, whether it's decarbonizing or electrifying something. So that's one part of it. The other thing we're looking for is some demonstration of commercial success. I think that that's because, you know, we're not trying to finance R&D. So we kind of, we would hope that it's through an R&D cycle and has managed to demonstrate some degree of commercial success in the market. And then the other thing is really that meaningful impact. So does it fit with the business's ethics as a whole? Does it fit with the energy transition? Does it make a meaningful impact? You know, is it something that we can be proud to stand up and say, you know, this is making a difference?
Okay. And what about, so you guys made quite a few investments. Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk through some of the companies? I know you're on a few boards. Mm-hmm. What do those companies do? What's the opportunity and why did Fred Olsen invest?
Sure. So one of the ones we invested in last year based in Wynnesh, which is near Reading, is Tepio. Tepio is a zero emissions boiler, so that's what they've created.
Do they call it ZEB or ZEB?
ZEB. That's the acronym, yeah. But if I said the ZEB.
I've seen the ZEB around places. I've seen the ZEB, Lloyd.
Yeah.
Okay, so they've got a zero emissions boiler.
Yes.
And how big is the company and what's the opportunity?
So the company, they are mid-30s people now from memory. And their opportunity is massive. That is decarbonizing heat. So heat is a huge issue in the UK. We heat most of our homes with gas. And that's actually the same in Western Europe. Not in Northern Europe, our Norwegian neighbors, Swedish, Finnish neighbors, they found the heat pump, they backed it, and they've got it in all their homes. But for some reason, the uptake of heat pumps in the rest of Western Europe hasn't been great.
I think it's bonkers. Do you have to explain, like, okay, we've got this business because in the UK we burn gas for heat, and they say, what? still do that?
There is an education piece. You know, when I first presented renewable heat as an idea, there was a bit of, you know, this flabbergasted reaction. Why is this an issue? One of the consumer concerns in the UK about heat pumps is they don't work in cold temperatures. But none of these people have obviously spent a January in Norway, because, you know, if you're heating your house in January in Norway with a heat pump, you can do it in the UK. Frankly, there's no issues there.
So is it mostly heat pump in Norway?
Yes, that's right. So they've got the highest uptake in Europe. We have the lowest uptake here. So you know, that's for lots of different reasons. I would say one of them is a scrambled subsidy regimen. The other one is customer inertia and sort of it's not a dynamic industry, the heat industry. So, you know, people only think about this when they have an issue or they need to make a change. But what Tepio is doing, which is really interesting, is firstly they're electrifying heat, so is a heat pump. But what a heat pump doesn't do in our housing stock, which is very leaky, leaks a lot of heat and hasn't been properly insulated, is it turns heat into a flexible load. And that's the interesting bit, because with a heat pump, you can retrofit a heat pump to most properties, but at great cost, and it will be running all the time in the winter months because of the building fabric. And what Tepio is doing is saying, here's 40 kilowatt hours of thermal storage in a thermal core within your house, and you can charge it when you like, and you can discharge it through the day so that you get a whole day's worth of heat, you know.
A bit like old storage heaters.
Correct, but just way better insulated, much higher thermal capacity, and with all the smart technology to make use of your agile tariffs so that you're charging optimum times and discharging when it's expensive. And that's really the crux of this, is it's turning that asset into a flexible load, you know, rather than saying, electrify everything, but everyone's using heat at the same time, because people use heat at the same time because they're cold at the same time.
So let's talk about each company in detail, because you and I have never really done this, so this is great.
Yeah, yeah.
So Tepio, what does it cost to get one of these boilers? It's for domestic, right? Or is it also?
It's for domestic. Yeah. So that boiler is effectively sized for the median house,
okay,
right? So it's not going to do the mansion. And similarly, in a flat, it might be a bit too big, but it's for the median house, so it's a mass market product. And cost-wise, I mean, it's somewhere in the region of £6,500 to £7,000.
Okay, so not far off a normal boiler, you know what I mean?
Worcester boiler. Correct. So it's a bit more than a gas boiler. It's less than a retrofitted heat pump for sure. I mean, you know, I just had a heat pump fitted. I got the subsidy, but mine still cost £13,000. You know, in a terrace house, so that gives you an idea of the sort of the scale
after
of the market.
The subsidy.
I was in the renewable heat incentive subsidy, which is a 7-year payback over the sort of the life of the running of the thing. So I will get most of that back, but having the money up front to be able to do that is what put huge amount of people off heat pumps because it is a significant capital investment. So this sits somewhere in between.
By the way, is that index linked?
Yes, it is. Yeah. Yes, it is. And there's a reason why that's now been shut down. So that's been replaced by something called the boiler upgrade scheme, which is a 5,000 upfront capital subsidy. But even still, you know, if you've still got to find another 7 or 8 grand, it's a lot of money, especially when the reason you're going to change is perhaps because you're getting hammered with energy bills.
And we've got the whole cost of living crisis. So
correct.
Someone finding a 10 grand down the back
correct.
Of the sofa, it's fairly
correct.
Unlikely. All right.
Yeah.
So that's Tepia. Are they just mainly UK based? I guess the market's big enough in the UK.
The market is plenty big enough here. I mean, they will be addressing Europe as well. But at the moment, it's about really demonstrating the scale in the UK, and they've got they're manufacturing the device in One Ash Triangle, and they'll be they're going through a growth phase at the moment.
There's a lot of really good businesses in One Ash.
Win
Ash keeps on coming up.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's not, you can't just think of The Office and Ricky Gervais. Down
no.
There. It's moved on a lot since the early 2000s. Yeah.
What about the other ones? So we've done Tepio.
Yeah.
Which other companies are you involved with?
So we invested in Measurable Energy last year, which is a smart
Measurable
plug.
Energy.
Yeah, Measurable Energy. So measurable.energy is a URL, and they are a smart plug socket and a software platform that sits behind that. Imagine a plug socket as it is, but behind
one of those.
But behind it, there's a PCB. And that is measuring power. It's also doing machine learning, and it's also doing control of the socket. So when you plug that lamp in, the socket's able to know from the power signal of that lamp that it is a lamp, and therefore it's a discretionary device, a discretionary load, and it can be turned off. So if you walk out of here at night and you don't turn it off, the socket will know that the office is finished and turn it off.
Because there's no power converter to, like, you have on a laptop or something like that, or a TV.
Correct.
It's not a DC. It's not a digital system. It's just a...
Exactly. It's all, yeah, exactly. It's all analog. So, you know, so most of the things that we plug in sockets aren't smart.
Yeah.
So there are some smart devices out there, but they're also dumb if you don't connect them to the system when you bought them, right? So so this is taking the human out of it, and that's the first thing. The other thing is they have a light on the front, which indicates different metrics. It can indicate the carbon intensity of the grid at the time. So you can then make a discretionary decision about when to take power.
Oh, so if I'm about to plug in my phone to charge it, I look at the front plate and it says, I don't know, red, I assume.
Red?
Yeah. It goes red, and I go, that's not very good for the environment.
It's pretty coaly, pretty gassy.
Yeah.
So,
okay,
then, exactly, and then you can do it later. Or you can actually have the app do that for you, so you can leave it plugged in, and then it charges or puts the power in when it's best to do so. Mm-hmm. But it also can do that for price. So if you're thinking about a time of view tariff, it's going green and red throughout the day because you can actually see, oh, it's cheap now, it's expensive, so I am or I'm not going to do that. I'm going to leave my 2,000 watt vacuum clean until 10 o'clock tonight. Yeah. Annoy the neighbors, but save some money, right? So that type of thing. And it is a B2B product, so it's for commercial buildings more than it is for domestic properties. I've used it in my own house, and I've used it as an extension lead for my laptop. I can see how much power I've used in relation to my work, so I can, you know, make a tax deduction off that if I liked, which is a nice little use case in itself, but it's really for commercial offices. And what they can get is about 15 to 20% overall power reduction for the building, which is incredibly meaningful.
Cool. That's very cool. I am surprised how slow smart plugs have taken. Smart plugs, I don't want to talk about sockets here, but smart plugs and stuff like that has been to really grab a hold. And I can't work out what it is, because I don't think it's cost.
Mm.
I don't think it's technology. Mm. What is it? Because we had Hive, and we had the Amazon stuff and the Google. This hasn't really happened.
Yeah.
I've got all of my, like, I'm kind of into home automation, as a lot of weird guys like me are into it. And I really, really like it. But I just can't believe how it just hasn't taken off.
I think, you know, I think you're absolutely right. 10 years ago, we were talking about Industry 4.0. We were talking about Internet of Things taking over the world. It was going to be the future. It hasn't really got there. I think that the reasons are, there's a few. Like, one is concerns over cybersecurity, which is always the big one. You know, the way that Measurable have made a difference is that each of their sockets is air gapped from the system. So you can't get into one and then shut everything down. You can only get into one if you really manage to break in over Wi-Fi. I think the other thing is the benefits. You know, a lot of the benefits of these things are gimmicky or tangential, right? I mean,
I love
how
the gimmicky ones.
Well, this is it. But you
New
know,
Year's Eve at midnight when all your lights go crazy.
Which
that's what I live for.
Well, and that's
obviously,
fine.
Obviously, what I mean was, there's no way I was at home. I was at a rave.
Yeah, exactly. No, it was just you on
it.
It
was me when Jules Holland
in the
I
living
guess.
Room. Yeah, yeah, exactly. So that's part of it, is the tangential benefits, right? And we were waiting for something which has got a meaningful benefit. Changing a plug socket is not an everyday decision. It's not something we think about. It's just there, and it works when it works. It doesn't work when it doesn't. Yeah. So you have to have something meaningful. You have to say, can I really save carbon? And are the energy savings big enough? And are the cost savings big enough to justify me getting a screwdriver out, risking electrocuting myself, and changing the socket or putting electricity?
How do you make it sexy? Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
I guess the carbon thing's sexy to, I would think carbon's cool, reducing carbon, but maybe most people don't care.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, so like sockets, it really matters what they look like.
Yes.
I guess for B2B it's not so bad, but for consumers, like if it doesn't look nice, you're not gonna put it in your house.
Yeah. Well, they look better than that one, I'll say that. exactly. It wasn't your decision. Wasn't your decision, but they have a strip light, and then light sort of it casts down on the socket, so it's like the whole thing's illuminated, but it really isn't.
Very nice.
And that reduces the standby wattage, of course, right? Because you can't have a smart socket in there that's actually a vampire device.
It's burning, yeah.
You know, even because that's what it was there to do in the first place, to save the power.
So that company's called Measurable Energy, or Measurable.Energy.
Yeah.
And what kind of size company is that?
So they are about 15 people. They are in Reading as well, so they're in the M4 corridor. Yeah. They've got about, you know, well, they've got a big basket now of commercial customers. They've got channel partners who are then distributing the devices onto their tenants in buildings, so real estate companies.
Do you have to pay a subscription?
Yes, you do. So
the cloud costs and all of that, the control, there's an overhead to that, right?
Exactly. So there's the capital cost of the device, which is not big. It's cheap for a smart socket. And then there's an ongoing subscription. It's a fairly nominal sum. And that's all priced around, you know, being less than the cost savings from the device itself, right, of course. So the idea is that, you know, the big benefit is the cost saving. A chunk of that goes to subscription. And then everyone shares in the impact of the device being installed.
I can't believe how long we've just spent talking about plug sockets.
I agree.
Absolutely.
I think this every day, but you know.
What about the other guys? So we've done Measurable Energy, Tepio. What are the investments that Fred Olsen made that are interesting, or that you're on the board of?
So on the board of, we set up a logistics business as well, which is fairly fledgling out of Felixstowe, doing green logistics. So. To help with scope for emissions, but that's fairly early stages. Some of my colleagues have invested in a business called New Power Partners, which is a offshore wind consultancy out of Denmark. We also invested in a battery technology company in Norway called Sonata, which is silicone anode coating. It's always a mouthful, but it's to increase the energy density of a lithium-ion battery. Correct. Yeah. So that's another one that we're in as well.
Sonata, spelt
C-E-N-A-T-E.
Cool. Yeah. So all over the place. And so what about the trends in? So a lot of what you do is venture capitalist stuff. So what are the key trends in venture capital? What do companies and startups in the energy space need to consider? What's happening out there at the moment? I guess the first thing to talk about is. There's a bit of a bloodbath in America, right, in valuations, in the stock market in general, but also in particularly later stage startups. So startups that have been around for a long time that are raising shed loads of cash are finding it more difficult, less so for earlier stage. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely spot on.
I'll ask another question.
Yeah, go on.
No, I'm only joking. I'm just answering my own questions here.
So 2020 and 2021, really defined as being this very hot market, lots of heady valuations, and a lot of it was in the US. I mean, Europe wasn't entirely insulated, but generally was from a lot of the valuation excesses. And there were some mantras which were going around. You know, you heard a lot. It was this kind of market share at all costs, growth at all costs. You know, that was the most important thing. If you can beat the competition, you can monopolize the market, and then you can get your free cash flow, right? But actually, that's a really expensive way to do it, and it sometimes ignores some key business fundamentals, which, you know, are never going away. There is always going to be the need to eventually get to profitability, to self-sustaining, and you can only do so many fundraising rounds. And so, you know, the one that's been in the news recently is Klarna. So Klarna raised a huge amount of money.
It's Klarna, now the sort of
buy now, pay later.
Buy a t-shirt now, pay for in 3 months' time.
Correct.
Whatever it works. Yeah.
So they fundraised, and then they've just done another in 2020, I think, or 2021. They've just done another fundraise, 87% down on the previous fundraise valuation. Right. So a huge haircut, and then there's lots of this in the public markets as well. You know, everything from Lemonade, the insurance business, to Lyft, the ride sharing. Energy Vault, Nikola, the vehicle company, they've seen massive adjustments in valuation. And, you know, a lot of this comes back to people actually really scrutinize those business models and looking for that, you know, that self-sustaining future. So where we sit as a European-focused investor is that, you know, we're quite happy that Europe is generally insulated from a lot of this.
What do you mean by insulated? As in, we didn't have the froth.
We didn't have
in the same
as much
kind of way as in America.
There were SPACs and there were fundraisers, but
SPAC being a
special purpose acquisition company. So this is where you've got a another company that's already listed on the stock market, and you do a reverse merger. So you put the new company into that. And it takes over it, you know, like the praying mantis. It sort of like consumes
this
it.
This is nuts, right? So just like a bit of an explain. This is how I understand it. So you could have like a 100-year-old, like you know, father and son business that in America that got on the stock market in like 1950 or whatever, and then they make widgets and have been doing that forever. But they kind of, that business has kind of gone down the pan. And then someone else comes in and goes, right, I'm going to buy that because you've already passed all the tests to get on the stock market. Get rid of the widget business, and now I've got an empty shell. And I'm going to go and acquire, I don't know, a startup that isn't yet making revenue.
Correct.
And then I've got them onto the stock market without having to go through all of the rigmarole of all of the legal and all of the stuff you have to do to get the stock market, as in float.
Yeah, and that's really what it comes down to. I mean, it's a regulation light way of raising public capital on a stock market listing. You know, everything, when you do a main market listing and you go IPO for the first time, the rigmarole is one way of putting it. I mean, I think that's a euphemism. It's a big process, right? And so this way of doing it is quicker, probably, you could argue, say, cheaper, but moreover, the scrutiny around the investment isn't there. So that was a big boom. And there were funds, SPAC funds, or funds of funds that were created to invest in SPACs that didn't actually have any assets, right? So you can see that there's this hungry capital looking for businesses, and the focus is on deployment. It's not on necessarily the quality of business or the portfolio. It's actually, we need to get this out the door because we're sat on this huge amount of capital. We're charging management fees for it. We need it to go somewhere. It needs a home. Yeah. And so this is you know, some of this is you know, there's a element of exaggeration and anecdote, but this is really what happened in the last couple of years. So there was a lot of that. A lot of it went into green tech or green stocks as well, and that was an element of frustration for me because, you know, from my point of view, I don't want the green transition to be hampered by a capital downturn because money's being thrown at things that it shouldn't have. You know, there is a lot to be said about sharing other success. You know, I hope this business does well because it's good for all of us. But there's also a lot to be said for, I hope this business doesn't raise money because that money could be better deployed somewhere else and could be better put to use elsewhere. So anyway, so that happened in the US. And it was, you know, clearly, you know, lots of people looking at traditional financial metrics like price to earning ratios, PE ratios, and they are off the scale of historical norms. And the party has to end at some point.
So companies are valued way more than their bottom. So the bottom line, so revenue in, you know, minus your expenses, sales minus expenses equals a business. And companies were valued, their stock price was way higher on multiples of that bottom line than really we'd seen before.
Yeah, and of course, when the bottom line didn't exist, so when there was no profitability or earnings before interest tax to talk about, they used a revenue multiple, which was a new thing. That's not really been a thing in the past. Yes, software businesses have been valued off annual recurring revenues, but using just a revenue multiple as a comparator it's ignoring everything that's going on beneath that. You know, if I go back to being an accountant, I'm thinking all that stuff that's happening underneath revenue, you're effectively casting aside and saying we value this business just on that. Well, it's not a sustainable way to do it. And you're ignoring too much about the business from a financial point of view on that. So that, as a valuation metric, kind of died, I think. You know, I don't hear people talk about that anymore.
So if I've got this right, and you'll know better than me, but the focus has changed from how much revenue do you make to are you cash flow positive, or if not, as in do you make money, are you profitable, or if not, when? Mm. Right? If not now, then
yeah.
when?
Right, yeah, there feels to be a push towards, you know, when do you get to free cash flow? Free cash flow positive. So, you know, when we think about a business that has a heavy working capital demand, so like a manufacturing business, the free cash flow is, you know, when they're not only profitable, but they're also managing that procurement and sales cycle yeah. such that more money is coming in than going out. And that's really an indicator of we don't want to be constantly propping this up with new fundraisers, because the problem with fundraising is that when you have to do it, it's not always the optimum time to do it. And you're beholden to market conditions, you're beholden to macroeconomics, venture cycles, whatever it may be. There is, you know, there is a good time and a bad time, and that is not in your gift. So, you know, that's definitely been a focus. But as I said, US has definitely been worse affected by it. It's been seen in the public markets and also in the venture markets. You won't see it straight away because, of course, these venture capital investments were held privately. So at the moment, they're held by the venture investor at book value, which is what they're invested at. And until there's a capital call, so until they actually need more money to go in, there is no markdown in that. So no one sees this until someone actually says, well, we need the money.
So we've got a load of companies out there. So we're talking specifically about the US, but in some European companies
yeah,
too.
Sure.
You've got companies out there that are still... You know, the last liquidity event, the last pricing of that, because they haven't floated on the stock market. The last pricing was super high, and then when the next need to raise some capital, that's when the adjustment happens. But we're not quite there yet. So
yeah.
So the trend is that 2020, 2021, there was a lot of money sloshing around, and some of that wasn't allocated in the most efficient way. Mm-hmm. And then that's having a knock-on effect with valuations and startups in general. So it's changed the world a little bit. But I think you're saying mainly in the US, but some over here. And I think we didn't have the kind of excesses over here.
Correct.
I don't think. Anyway, I don't know what's normal. I'm only 31 years old. But it doesn't feel like we had the kind of excesses over here that they did over there.
That's right.
And what are the trends that are happening, particularly in VC and in clean tech? You know, what's happening?
Sure. Yeah, and I just think it's worth mentioning as well that a lot of this is driven by the interest rate environment as well. So, you know, having zero negative interest rates forces money into higher returning assets. So, you know, when you think about institutional investors, they're putting more of their portfolio into venture capital than they have in the past, which is again driving this. Mm-hmm. Now we're in a changing interest rate environment. That obviously has an effect on the market as well, and it has an effect on how people view long-term returns. But where we're at now, one of the things that I said to you before is that we're in an industry which isn't discretionary, it's necessary. Mm-hmm. So there are fundraisers and companies going to market at the moment which are in sectors which you would say are discretionary. They are improving something or providing a market niche, but there's not necessarily the drive as there is in clean tech that it has to happen. It has to happen or we're all cooked. You know, that type of thing. So clean tech in Europe certainly has been in part insulated, I think. And, you know, there is not just the market pressure for something like an energy efficiency innovation like measurable energy. We know that EPCs in commercial buildings are going to be really important, such that you won't actually be able to lease a space unless it meets a particular requirement.
That's the, like, green to red rating you have when
Correct.
You rent a place, right?
So any of these technology, these efficiency technology businesses will help that. And those are the kind of wider market conditions. So we've seen what's happened the last couple of years with interest, but we don't think that it's going to necessarily knock us off course to where we're going.
Okay. So you and your team see a lot of companies, a lot of slide decks, I imagine, a lot of pitches, slide decks, offers. Mm. What kind of companies do you, I don't want to say admire here, not necessarily ones in your company, in your portfolio, but what kind of companies are out there that you think are really cool?
Yeah.
And why?
So
I'll give you some time to think about it if you want some.
No, I mean, it's fine. I mean, you're right. We see a lot of things all the time. I think that I'll mention two for very different reasons. So one is a German business called Empal. And they,
how do you spell that?
It's an E-N-P-A-L.
P-A-L?
P-A-L, yeah.
Okay, Empal.
Empal. I was made aware of this business a little while ago. They just did a big Series C with SoftBank and some others.
Wow, okay.
And I think they're a unicorn now, based on the last valuation round.
Unicorn meaning?
Worth over €1 billion euros,
okay.
In this case, right? Why it's interesting is what they're doing is really simple. They are an installation business. So they are going around residential properties and sticking solar on and a battery on if you want it, and also an EV charger. But
cool. In Germany?
In Germany. And I think they're going elsewhere as well. But the reason why I like it is because it's a really slick model. So if you think about the UK market now, if you want solar panels, you've got to go to a local installation business or a regional one at best. You've got
it's
long lead times. You've got to get someone to come around for a quote, and then they won't also do the battery, and they won't also do the EV charger. So it's all disaggregated.
And then I've got to go to someone else like Octopus, and they don't know, and do they are they going to talk to each other properly?
Exactly, and it's like, unless you're in the industry, you don't know whether to ask for the EV charger, does it solar match? So, if the solar's on, does it charge my car? Because I could get a dumb EV charger that doesn't charge my car from the solar, and then I think, well, actually, all I can do with it is dump it in the hot water tank or hopefully the Tepio or whatever it is in the house at the time. But what this business is doing is they're trying to turn it into a very slick turnaround. So you inquire, you get a quote which is fixed or as near as it can be, and then you get an installation team comes out, they put a commoditized solar panel on the roof, which they've got stock of, so they can do it at very short turnaround times, drop a wire through the house, an electrician comes out, wires up to the inverter, to the home battery if you want, and to the EV charger, and that's it. And you've got, and you can do it as a leasing option, or you can do it as a capital payment option, so you don't have the upfront cost, and there's asset financing available for that. And I just think that that's the type of solution that we need to roll out disaggregated generation, because I'm a massive believer in disaggregated generation everywhere. Everyone should have solar. Everyone should have that capability. Not necessarily a home battery, because if we all get EVs, why would I get an 8 kilowatt hour home battery if I've got a 64 kilowatt hour? And I like to believe that companies like Indra, which is a bi-directional charging business, they will be in a lot of homes, so that you can do both and you can take
that,
it and
by the way,
give
that
it back.
Whole the battery math there doesn't get talked about enough. So this whole 4 kilowatt solar on the roof or whatever it is, home Tesla power pack, whatever it is in your, what do you call them? The ones
Powerwall.
Powerwall, right? Yeah. I think a Powerwall is like 5 kilowatt hours, something like that.
Yeah.
So, and then you've got a 100 kilowatt hour Tesla outside. So you need 20 Powerwalls to charge your Tesla. So I think it's a great idea, but you need a very big battery to match your car at home if you want a fast charge.
Correct.
Anyway, yeah.
Yeah, correct. And this is the thing. I mean, there's
I don't want to be like the Daily Mail answer, like, it's not going to work.
Yeah.
There's
a little bit that needs to happen in the vehicle to home or vehicle to X, whatever you want to call it. I mean, I saw on LinkedIn someone using an electric mower off his Hyundai, which just blew my mind. I was like, that's brilliant. You could take your lawnmower around and cut the lawn, on the neighbor. Anyway, so there's a bit that needs to happen there. There is a bit that needs to happen.
Yeah.
Part of it is around sharing the benefits, who gets the benefits from what you're doing, and how do you actually get that into, if you're playing in the balancing mechanism. So you're getting revenues from that by offering up your battery for flexibility services. How do you actually get paid off that? Kind of has to be through your energy provider. It has to be through the utility, and the utility has to be on board with that. And let's be honest, some of them are able to do that, some of them are not at the moment. So there's things that need to happen, but at the same time, just looking at those raw economics or those raw physical storage sizes in a home battery versus a vehicle, I would like to see an EV. A charger and solar on every home.
So this company, Enpal, are in Germany. They're worth more than a billion euros, and they just go. They've just nailed this process.
Just nailed it. It's just a slick operational exercise. And if I go through that process now and I want to do it for my own house,
in the UK,
it is painful. In the UK, it is painful.
Forget it. Apart from being expensive, right?
Yeah.
If you're going to spend that much money, at least it should be easy to do.
Correct.
But it's, you know, it's very difficult to do. Correct. What about, you said you had another one before we get lost.
So the other one is another German business, which is now owned by Shell, called Next Kraftwerk. I think you know them.
I've been to some. So they always do good parties.
Do they?
So okay. I think I went to that. They had like a stand party in E-World in Essen, I think, about 4 years ago.
Yeah.
And it was off the chain.
Right.
But they're massive, right?
We need to get to Germany then for that. Do some VPP parties.
So they're a really cool business. I was at Kiwi Power at the time. And they're an aggregator, right? But they have got such scale.
Yeah.
And they've done so many different countries in one go.
Correct.
And centralized it. Correct. And they've got a great brand, they've got a great management.
Yeah.
And they do good parties.
Yeah, I was looking at it when Shell bought it, and it, you know, probably would have been out of our reach at the time. But I mean, I think that it's a really interesting business. They are a virtual power plant, or VPP for short. What they're doing is they are bringing together flexible loads, flexible generation, and energy trading. So it's this vertical integration where you're managing both the generation and the load at the same time. And it's kind of, I like to think of it like a synthetic PPA, which I know you know what that is, but you know, so the idea that you're selling power to an offtaker or a customer on the other side of the grid, you have to transport it over the grid, but it's as if the transaction works as if you were next door and it was over a private wire from a solar panel to a factory, right?
Just lobbing a cable over the
Correct.
Fence.
Correct. Yeah. And it's just a very elegant solution. Now I looked today, they've got now 10 gigawatts under management.
Yes.
It's absolutely
incredible.
Massive scale. And by using that in an intelligent way, so actually managing those loads and generations, you know, holistically aggregating it and then offering up to the grid, you are an invaluable resource to the German grid.
For reference, right? I'm pretty sure that in the UK, the biggest aggregator, I'm going to get shot down for this, but getting above a gigawatt is tough for UK aggregators.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think the biggest one was Limejump at one point. They had a couple of gigawatts, something like that. And then you got to question how you're counting that, because some of it's just capacity market, some of it's other stuff.
Mm.
So these guys have got 10 gigawatts, not in one country, but probably 10 countries in Europe.
Yeah.
With all these different TSOs, different rules and regulatory systems, billing, payments, all of it.
Mm.
Very, very cool.
Yeah, it's cool. And you know, look, you can really see the value of that. Rather than all these things working, all these different assets, generating assets and loads working independently, doing what they want, by bringing it all together and trading it as one, it's of huge value. And it's really a big part of the future. So when we think about, you know, this kind of discussion with how much do you need to put into the grid, how much you need to invest in the grid, how much you need to invest in electrification, and then how much can you alleviate those investments with smart technology, this is one of the businesses I look at and think, this is an alleviation which actually negates some of the capital investment in the grid that you need, and perhaps negates some of those other investments in electrification.
Well, we've both got a crush on Next
Kraftwerk.
How do you say it? Next Kraftwerk?
Kraftwerk, I think, yeah.
Oh, it's great to say as well.
Yeah.
All right, what else is going on? Trends. So what's going on in the battery world? What are you seeing and what are you thinking about?
What is a battery?
You guys do you do some pumped hydros?
We are looking at that at the moment. Yeah, we are looking at pumped hydro. I think, you know, when we think about storage, we are trying to take a really broad view. You know, what you're doing in lithium ion storage is fantastic. And, you know, we're obviously a great admirer of your work. We're also a great admirer of
that's
that.
Very kind of you, Lloyd.
That's all right. I was paid to say that. But, you know, don't forget that, you know, when we look at what the research you're putting out, when we look at the dispatch durations, we're talking 1 to 2 hour assets at the moment, right?
At the moment, right? But we're going to have a showdown in a second. I know where you're going with this.
I know. All I'm looking at now, I'm looking at that intraday generation, and I'm looking every day at the gas peak, and I'm saying, how do we displace that peak? How do we displace that hump in the day?
And it's not 1 or 2 hours, right?
Right, and you know, if we think about you know, a day in the life of the UK's grid, take the UK for example, you know, 24, 25 gigawatts at night and 40 in the peak of the day or something like that, and sometimes it rises higher as we saw in the heat wave the other week.
Mad that that's an example now, by the way, because the example should be the third Wednesday after Christmas or whatever it is that National Grid always is. And now we've got these crazy events.
But especially when we're a country without really air conditioning, of course, as well, and especially in domestic properties. But I think a lot of that was due to infrastructure strain more than necessarily the demand cycle. But anyway. So you look at that hump, that's what we're trying to get away. How do we get rid of that? I'm not necessarily worried about the 2 weeks in the year where we have to draw on a gas storage system to power the grid in the Dunkelflaut, as the Germans call it. You know, the dark doldrums, the not sunny, the not windy bit. Yeah. But I am worried about the 50 weeks of the year, the fact that every day we're drawing on these CCGTs, combined cycle gas turbines, and they are filling in the grid, right? That's what I'm worried about. And I know that batteries have a massive role to play, or lithium-ion batteries, but we also think about things like pumped hydro as a really interesting flexible resource in that space. We're also looking at thermal storage, as you know, but thermal storage can also just be not in the residential setting, it can be in the grid setting as well. Now, the caveat I would add about thermal storage is that where we like it is where it's electricity to heat and it stays as heat.
I was going to say, to be clear about thermal storage, right? Yeah. We mean turning electricity, getting something hot, and turning that heat back to electricity later.
No. Well, you could mean that.
Or do you mean using the heat?
I mean using the heat because if we think about heat as a load, as a energy consuming end use, it's somewhere around a quarter of our use at the moment. So if you do that, so if you do electricity to heat and then convert it back to electricity, the cases that I've seen, the losses are great. They're huge. So, your round trip efficiency is very poor, and that undermines a business case.
By the way, there's some guys who are doing it into coal as well. Turn electricity into coal, I know I'm not using engineering parlance here, but get things cold, store it as cold.
Oh, yeah, cold storage, sure. Yeah, so there's a few of them as well.
We're just talking about the hot side now.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. But it's the delta, right? The temperature delta between the ambient, right? And where it's interesting, I think, is where it stays as heat. And there's plenty of areas where if you can use thermal storage for a heat end use, so you're displacing the gas, the local gas generation, or the direct electricity generation from that point, that's really interesting. And there's a business called Energy Nest, actually, which is out of Norway. Yeah. They are doing that for industrial processes. I think that's a great concept because what they're effectively doing is they're storing the heat and then they're using it as high temperature process steam, in like a bottling plant or in pharmaceutical applications, and displacing gas. So they're displacing gas locally, but when we think about the grid as a whole, thermal storage, I don't see that as being a way to displace the intraday because you've obviously got to convert it back.
What material do you store? So you need something with, I'm going back to the engineering days, but something with a high latent heat capacity.
Correct.
Right? So what kind of material suits that? We need Tim here, who's a mechanical engineer, can probably tell us.
Yeah, I mean, you're asking the wrong person, but the ones that I've seen, they're in some solid medium. So it's either a rock or a concrete-based medium, rocks, or a mixture of rocks and metals, so aluminium, for example. It's got a very high latent heat.
What about gravity? Let's talk gravity for a second. Have you guys looked at? I haven't managed to make the numbers work personally. You need a vector gravitricity.
Gravitricity is
there's
one.
There's a few of them that are doing this gravity storage thing where like you roll something up a hill and get it down again, or you make a big hole in the ground and then lift it out. Are you guys looking at those kind of companies?
Well, gravitational.
By the way, this feels like it's a bit of a people's front of Judea conversation, right? Because all energy storage is good, and I don't want to start disrespecting other energy storage technologies, but I just don't get the round trip efficiency thing on these.
I hear you. So gravitational storage for just to be clear does include pumped hydro, right? And from my perspective, the best gravitational storage is pumped hydro. And let's not forget, if you look at global storage at the moment, that's pretty much all done with pumped hydro in some form. And just again, to be clear, pumped hydro is moving water between a lower tail pond and upper tail pond. And so, when you've got the excess power, you're pumping it up. And when you don't have it, you're letting it come back downhill. And that as a round trip efficiency is somewhere around the 75 to 80%. And we've got four or five.
Is it as high as 80%? I thought it went as high. Someone told me the highest it goes is 76%.
Okay.
Well, that's still
in my range of 75%. Yeah, it was.
Because that was, I think De Norwig is somewhere around there. Someone can tell us better. But it's an old site, right?
Right. And there's De Norwig, there's Cruachan in Scotland as well, which is another one, which is actually in a planning phase to get increased capacity. So I think it's about 400 megawatt flexibility asset now. So pretty big. It's going to be a gigawatt if they get consented. Awesome. So it's a huge asset. And when pumped hydro is sized, it's sized around generally a 6 to 10 hour duration cycle. So again, thinking about relinquishing that bit of intraday gas generation, that seems to me like it could solve the problem alongside some, you know, interconnector flexibility, right?
Yeah.
But when we think about the other...
We don't disagree yet.
Right.
Yet.
So when we think about the other gravitational storage businesses, Gravitricity is one. I understand the base out of
Scotland.
I didn't
want to single them out, actually.
Gravitricity.
Tricity. I didn't want to single you out. There's many other ones.
There are many others. So they're doing it, as I understand, in abandoned mine shafts. So they're moving a weight up and down the abandoned mine shafts. I think that the most high-profile one is Energy Vault. Which has attracted huge amounts of money from different high-profile investors. And their concept is to construct a tower, which has got a series of pulleys and weights. And they move these weights, which are concrete blocks, effectively, up and down. And the latent energy, the inertia stored in that gravitational, the gravitational potential energy of that rock being up high, as it comes back down to Earth, is released. Now, the whole premise of it, as I understand, is that they are, you know, unbreakable. There is minimal maintenance, and you know, it's a very easy solution. It's mechanically easy.
What goes up must come down. So the oldest saying in the book, right?
Yeah, but will it go up again?
Yeah, exactly.
So I think there's general concerns. I think there's concerns from the actual amount of energy you can store. I mean, when we think about big
slabs, right?
Right. And when we think about pumped hydro, you know, we're looking at is, in very simple terms, we're looking at the volumetric amount of water. We're looking at the gravitational constant 9.8, and then we're looking at the head, so the distance.
Yeah.
But the big difference between something like pumped hydro and something like moving blocks around is that you're never going to be able to store as much weight as you could in water and reservoir and blocks. So that's going to be an order of magnitude difference.
Unless you're lifting a city up and down, right?
Correct. And then the other thing is, well, how far can you actually move it up and down? So the pumped hydro sites, most of them are above 200 meters head. So 200 meters height difference between the top pond and the bottom.
Wow, I didn't realize it was that high.
Yeah. So it's big, right? Whereas something like Energy Vault, you can't realistically expect a 200 meter structure. So the structures are going to be 50, 60 meters tall. So your head effectively is drastically less.
So you discount your storage by like three or four times because it's 50, 60 versus 200.
Correct. And obviously then if you did have a 200 meter tower, you know, structurally what does that look like? Where are you gonna build it? And
so this basic maths we're talking through here, these gravity companies must also be able to do this basic math. So they must know something that we don't.
Correct. And you know,
I don't know what it is.
I mean, that's just my humble opinion. You know, I would always rather the storage medium as water being moved up and down than blocks on pulleys. But you know, that is just my opinion. And the fact is that we have not built any pumped hydro in this country for 40 years. So
yeah, because the planning regime, this is the thing, right? It's so
planning,
so
there's
slow.
There's getting the right topography, and you know, obviously if you're flooding something and building massive dam walls, so it's all well and good saying we could do this, but it's actually what's achievable.
Yeah.
And maybe, you know, in the case of the ones that we've you know, aforementioned, maybe they are achievably built, whereas pumped hydro is that bit more difficult to get away. And of course the construction cycle of something like pumped hydro is very long,
yeah,
right? So you're looking at 7 to 10 years, which obviously then has a huge effect on how it's viewed from a capital perspective, because it's money in up front and it's a long time until you get anything back. But it's still, you know, as a technology, I still think it's the tried, trusted, and CapEx, scalable method.
You're spending CapEx over that 7 years of building something. Mm. So you've lost money. You're already down by year eight, quite a long way. It's not like building a battery where it takes you 6 months to build and you're making money.
Correct.
That's the idea, of course.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. I want to talk about a couple more things. We've got a bit more time, if that's all right. Interconnectors. I know you have a very big passion for interconnectors.
I love an interconnector.
What's going on with interconnectors, Boyd?
Well, I mean, I was looking at the wholesale markets yesterday, and the wholesale market in the UK, the day ahead price was about £282 a megawatt hour.
Yep.
France, 440 euros a megawatt hour. So even if you adjust for exchange rate, that's pretty good, because what that means is that, you know, until now, the interconnector with France has been reliably supplying the UK with 8 to 10% of its power needs almost 24 hours a day.
Because the French nukes supplying us, because we needed the power. It was almost happening consistently one way from France to the UK.
Correct. And it was like 23 hours a day. And then because of the difference between GMT and CET, the French peak happens slightly earlier than the UK. So the interconnectors are switched for 30, 45 minutes in the morning and the evening to send power back to France. And then for the rest of the day, we were just a net importer, right?
Yep.
But now a lot of the maintenance is overrun, so it's, you know, they were expected to be back online, they're not, and what that's meaning is that we're actually using that interconnector to sell power into France, and that's actually subsidizing the huge power prices that we're paying at the moment. And you're also seeing the other European countries doing this as well, right? So
subsidizing the power prices.
I'm thinking about the energy system as a whole, right? So if we're exporting power to France, We're generating at the strike price of, let's say, £280 a megawatt hour, and we're exported to France and selling into their market at 440.
So we're going to we're blaming the French for our high power prices in this conversation.
Correct. Well, it's kind of similar. So the NordLink cable with Norway, this has become a hot political topic in Norway, because Norwegian power prices historically have been very low.
Yeah.
They've started to go up significantly because Norway has been exporting at max capacity to the UK.
Because
we're the bid. And they've got low water reserves in the hydro, because most of their grid, almost all their grid is hydro, right? So the Norwegian consumer is complaining that their power prices are going up. Why are we shipping this power over to the UK? But in reality, they are benefiting. I know that they don't feel the economics in their monthly bill, but they are benefiting because the government is collecting all that bank and then passing it back down through the municipality. So, you know, they are doing it. But if you look at the European markets again with France, you know, I saw that Switzerland was importing from Germany and then selling over its interconnector to France, again, to profit from this arbitrage. Because so interconnectors are great. I love interconnectors. Interconnectors need to be built thick and fast. The main premise for them is, firstly, is the geopolitical unity. So you obviously need that there. You need to not threaten to turn off someone's interconnector. You need to remain friends for the duration of time. But the reason why it really works is because you get different peaks and troughs in wind generation as depressions move across Europe. So you need the ability to move that peak power around, and that's what the interconnectors enable. But of course, they don't work just on their own, because, you know, everyone has power needs, and you can't always rely on your neighbours to supply your needs when you really need it.
Yeah.
But we saw in the heat wave that nearly £10,000 a megawatt hour was paid by the UK grid from Belgium to import power in an emergency situation, because otherwise we're going to have a blackout in the south. So, you know, that's also the cost of it.
It's funny though, right? Because the newspaper, all the media around that was, we're paying the Belgians all this money. Mm. But it didn't take into account that if we didn't, we wouldn't have enough generation, right? That would be bad.
Yeah.
That would cost way, way more.
Yeah.
The problem isn't the Belgians.
No.
The problem is we have completely invested in our electricity system for too long.
Correct.
All right, I've got one more other thing I want to talk to you about. E-fuels.
Mm.
Actually, I've got two more things to talk about. If we've got time, we'll look at the producer, we're okay. Getting nods. E-fuels, talk to me.
So e-fuels are going to be part of the transition. It's just how big and where they play a role. So an e-fuel or a synthetic fuel effectively is starting with what we're going to call biogenic carbon dioxide. So, you know, something that's captured from a carbon dioxide waste stream, something that's been burnt. and then adding
biogenic.
So as in it was a fossil.
Yeah.
It's being burnt. It's then being captured.
Yeah.
And then you're using that
in this.
Yeah. Right. So that is added to hydrogen. So you're reversing thermodynamics. So you're making a molecule from bringing these two things together.
Yep.
Now, where would you see it? I mean, the real obvious one is in the aviation industry. Sustainable aviation fuel is one of the things.
Holy grail, so we can all still go on lovely holidays to
wherever. Correct.
We
go. It's like having your cake and eating it. Now, the problem is the cost. You know, it is prohibitively expensive because there is, you know, the price of kerosene does not account for its negative externality, right? Which is burning and producing CO2 and also doing it at 38,000 feet. And that also having a radiative forcing effect. So that's the obvious one. But there are others out there. The round trip efficiency is very poor. But you know the proponents of it are saying, well, if we're capturing the CO2 and we're making hydrogen, this is not only a way to decarbonize these hard to abate areas like aviation. It's also a medium in which it can be stored long for a long time. Right? I mean, you think about when we store energy chemically in batteries. You know, if you leave it charged up, you're not going to just leave it charged up for a week. You're going to be dispatching it. But could you have an e-fuel sat in tanks? Well, we can call them e-tanks. They're clever tanks. But could you have that stored in tanks for weeks, months, and of course you could. I mean, that's what we've been used to doing. So that part of it feels good. The cost of it's high. So we hope that there's going to be a subsidy regimen for this. And that looks like the direction that is being pursued by governments. And we hope that there's volume enough for the off-takers to actually rely on that. So, you know, sustainable aviation fuel companies are signing off-take agreements with airlines. But the other one, of course, is shipping, right? So shipping is really tough, really tough.
But the good thing about shipping is you don't have to get it all that way in the air. You can kind of just put it on a big ship.
True.
So there's a physics benefit to being in the water than the air.
Of course, because you're not actually creating the upwards thrust and then having to keep it
and all the
airborne.
Carbon cost of doing that, which is crazy.
But the
shipping's
downside
filthy,
is,
isn't it?
Shipping's filthy, right? So the big improvement in shipping was moving off bunker, which is heavy sulfur fuel, so fuel oil, and ships that bought bunker still continue to do so, but they have to have scrubbers on board, which takes the sulfur content out, or they've gone on to marine diesel, effectively like low sulfur diesel. Now, so that was a big change. That was you know, we were all thinking we were electrifying. Well, the ships have just moved off heavy sulfur onto sort of a cleaner diesel. The difficulty is ships move a long way without refueling. So most ships will have 20 or 30 days of fuel in them, which, you know, from an electrification point of view is pretty much impossible.
Yes,
so absolutely. It has to be another method. And, you know, when we think about a ship as well, when it's built and financed, you want it to run for 25 or 30 years. So you've got to think about the ships that are being built now at scale, which are still being built to burn diesel.
Until
can you have a compatible fuel with that?
Yeah.
Because they are going to be run. They're not going to be scrapped. And realistically, the drivetrains of them aren't going to be retrofit. It's very difficult to do. So, you know, it's not like you can put a massive hydrogen tank in and say, we'll take half the capacity of this container vessel to store hydrogen. It's not going to happen. But you could.
Much bigger
tank. Yeah, exactly. But you could see a future where you've got the existing combustion engine, but you're burning something else. And there are alternatives now.
Or abating. Or.
Well, there is onboard carbon captures. We've seen a couple of projects for that, which is one way of doing it. Particularly if you burn impure oxygen so that you can capture a more concentrated CO2 waste stream as opposed to just burning normal air. But, you know, there are options out there now. So there's drop-in green diesel fuel, which is a biofuel produced. There's obviously the e-fuels. And then there's things like methanol and ammonia, which are being talked about as well, all with their different positives and negatives. You know, methanol, for example, well, it's still a carbon-based fuel, so it's still going to produce CO2. Ammonia is a horribly poisonous explosive chemical. If a ship ran aground and dumped ammonia everywhere, that would be way worse than the worst oil spill you've ever seen. You know, there's lots of different things going around there that people are talking about. But for me, It's always about being pragmatic and realistic. If you're building a ship now, you have to think about a fuel which is going to be compatible with the ships that are being built now. Otherwise, if you design another solution for a ship built in 20 years' time, we've already failed.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So still lots of work. I would love to have a separate conversation about shipping as well. And I know you and the team are looking at it in detail. The words green diesel always make me feel a little bit scared, but of course there's a pragmatism to it. Mm. So is there anything else that we should cover? I usually say, is there anything you want to plug? But we've covered a lot of bases here. Mm. Anything that Fred Olsen or one of the portfolio companies is working on that we haven't covered that you feel like, got to get out there, now's the chance?
There's nothing that I can particularly think. I would do a shameless plug, you know. That's always nice, and thanks for the offer. But I think we've covered it all, really.
All right, cool. Yeah. Well, thanks for coming on. Yeah. And we've talked about a lot of stuff, which we'll put in the show notes. So if you're interested in any of these companies or finding out more, please do check the show notes at the bottom on Spotify or however you're listening. And then remember to subscribe. We've been told that we need to say this more. So please, please, please do hit the subscribe button because it makes our numbers go up, and that's really important. All right, thanks very much. Cheers, guys.